This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. You've likely heard the saying before that the personal is political. Well, this next matter is definitely very personal and can also be highly political. It's just something we don't talk much about, not on the radio, not in public, sometimes not even privately. But sociologist Sarah Thornton is out to change that. Sarah has a new book out all about breasts. It's called Tits Up: What Sex Workers, Milk Bankers, Plastic Surgeons, Bra Designers, and Witches Tell Us About Breasts. Sarah Thornton, hello.
Thanks for having me, Pia.
So a lot of listeners are raising an eyebrow at this point. So first off, just briefly, tell the more skeptical among us or eye-rolling listeners why we need to be talking about this.
Well, it's interesting. The women's movement and feminists and people interested in women's equal rights, there has been a lot of writing and research and agitation around uteruses, wombs, and vaginas. And actually, there has been very little discussion of breasts. I started thinking about this after having a double mastectomy and reconstruction. I was really confused and wanted to know what I'd lost. So I started reading. And I read some great stuff. There's a few great historical books. There's, you know, some philosophy. There's some psychology. There's a lot about breast cancer and a lot specifically about breastfeeding. But there was very little that was in the moment, fairly recent, kind of talking about this complex culture of breasts that we live in North America.
I'm glad we're talking about this. So when you were just talking, I heard you say the word breasts, but your book is called Tits Up. So you use the word tits. And I think when we talk about this, language is important. So why did you choose tits instead of breasts?
When you talk to a boy who's about to graduate from high school, and you ask them, hey, what do you and your buddies call these things? You know, putting my hands on my chest. Your average boy, young man, will rattle off with some joy 8, 9, 10 words. Hooters, jugs, rack, tits is one of them. If you talk to a teenage girl the same age and say, hey, what do you and your girlfriends call these? If they're a white girl in America, and I think in Canada, where I grew up, they're most likely to say breasts and boobs. And actually, in the southern states, black women are more likely to use breasts and titties. But the number one word on the internet is tits. And tits is a man's word. It's actually the word for the sexualized breast. God forbid we should tit feed. You know, we breastfeed. You know, one never talks about tit cancer. It's a very specific kind of word, but it is the kind of dominant perspective on breasts in our culture today, which is that they're erotic playthings. And in a way, if women want to reclaim their chests, which I think we need to, I think we have to reclaim some of the language around them and not retreat into a shameful place where we feel comfortable using only two words.
Sarah, you mentioned you had a double mastectomy and that changed how you thought about your tits, your breasts, whatever word you feel comfortable using. What changed for you?
I had not really given my breasts that much thought. And I think I was amongst the majority of women who actually almost don't like to think about them, who maybe dismiss them as not that important or irrelevant appendages, sometimes dumb boobs. And so I was thinking about what I'd lost and puzzling over the natural breasts I had had, but I was also going, oh my God, I had these implants because I also had reconstruction. I called them Bert and Ernie. I felt quite alienated from them. They did not feel like the real thing. Because they cut off all the nerve endings when you have a mastectomy to make sure they don't miss any cancer, you know, what had been a kind of sentient and kind of organic part of my body became like dumb and mute and uncommunicative. Mm. So it was like really the contrast between me not having thought about these things, but then actually they were communicating to me all the time. You know, you kind of knew when you were going to get your period, or you knew when you were cold, or you knew when you might have the potential to be aroused. And then, of course, when you're a young mother, you can be in the grocery store and a baby cries in another aisle and you don't even consciously hear that infant. And lo and behold, you have let down. And let's just hope you're wearing a little padding.
Only laughing because been there, done that, right? I want to ask you about your implants because it's an important story that you tell in your book. You asked your surgeon that you said, listen, can you please give me, quote, lesbian yoga boobs? So you'd explain what you meant by that, but also what kind of boobs you did get.
Well, I had been a B cup most of my life, except when I was pregnant and breastfeeding. And I love swimming and I love yoga. And I had heard from some girlfriends that they had come out of reconstruction with larger breasts. So it wasn't really a reconstruction, but an augmentation. Mm. So I was alert to this, and I was really clear with my surgeon, who is very nice man, top of his field. And I said, look, I've been a B all my life. Somewhere between, I just want placeholders, somewhere between an A and a B. Let's call them A plus boobs. So then after the surgery, you know, you're bandaged up, you're swollen, you've got tubes coming out of you. You're just feel bulky anyway. So I wasn't sure what had happened. But, you know, when I started wearing clothes again, I realized I couldn't fit my jackets on. Mm. And then when I went to be fitted for my first bra, like 3 or 4 months later, I had gone from being a B cup to being a D cup. You know, it is a problem with the plastic surgery business, which has a history of being very male dominated, and also the reconstruction, the post-cancer reconstructions did evolve somewhat out of the augmentation business. I went in for breast reconstruction and I got a boob job.
But you write about why you think that was, not just for you, but sort of, as you say, the industry. Like, why does that happen?
I think that in medicine, there is still a problem with women not being heard. And I think there is a sense amongst many plastic surgeons, and it might be generational, that, you know, they know the measurements. They know what is aesthetically best. And it was very uncomfortable. I would bump into people with my breasts. I would bump into the kind of the threshold of the door, or, you know, or the edge of the door frame. I didn't feel myself, basically.
And so the bigger is better kind of thing. Like, I'll tell you what boobs are good boobs, so to speak.
Exactly. And, you know, what's interesting, when I went into operating rooms and started watching other people having breast surgeries of all kinds, you know, augmentations, lifts, reductions, I learned a hell of a lot about aesthetics and trends and fashions in breast size. Mm-hmm. So breast augmentations in the U.S. have plateaued, and they plateaued in 2007. Hmm. However, breast surgeries of all kinds continue to rise, and one of the trending surgeries is implant removal. And usually when you have an implant removal, you really need a lift because the implant has stretched the skin so much that the implant kind of disfigures what would have been your natural breast.
Hmm. If you're just joining us here on the Sunday Magazine, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with sociologist Sarah Thornton all about breasts. She has a new book out. It is called Tits Up. So if we're having a cultural shift in the West, or at least in North America, from the bigger is better when it comes to breasts or boobs, to people getting rid of their implants, like, where did this start, this idea? You're a sociologist. Where did this bigger is better sort of thing in your country and mine? Where did it start from? And how does that notion, how's it held up, like, both over time and across cultures?
You know, in the early 20th century, legs were much more fetishized than breasts. And you can see that in Hollywood stars like Betty Grable, whose legs were insured for $1 million. But then in the post-war period, there was a switch, and it's actually, you can identify it pretty clearly between 1952 and 1953. Betty Grable was the top actress in Hollywood in 52. And then lo and behold, 1953, Marilyn Monroe makes it big. And she, you know, her assets were above the waist, you know, her bosom was a subject of conversation. It was practically its own character in some of her movies. And of course, 1953 also marks the inauguration of Playboy magazine. And she was on the cover in December 53 and also was their centerfold. Centerfolds in 53 were topless, but not bottomless. Hmm.
And then, of course, through the years, we had Pamela Anderson, like, I'm just trying to think, yeah, of others that we sort of looked at them for their boobs. But as you say, that things are changing now culturally in North America.
I mean, now I think most women, particularly younger women, want a more athletic physique. Athleticism and large or extra large implants don't go well together. You know, you don't want to add extra weight to your bosom if you love running, or if you love yoga for that matter. You know, when you put implants under the muscle, which is where they're usually placed, you stretch out those pectoral muscles and weaken them substantially. And it can be pretty uncomfortable doing a chaturanga, you know, or a yoga push-up.
Tell me about this, because I mentioned that this is how we see them in the West and have. How does sort of our Western notions, as you talk to people about, you know, misconceptions and sort of culture, you know, in the West, predominantly, breasts are wildly sexualized, as you said. So how does our view of them as sort of erotic objects track with the rest of the world?
It's anomalous. The fetishization of breasts actually started amongst the French aristocracy during the Renaissance, and it partly had to do with the rise of wet nursing. And so when a breast is separated from its primary raison d'être, its primary function, you know, the only evolutionary reason why women have breasts and why men have nipples for that matter is because women hydrate, nourish, and immunize the young. You know, it's part of the survival of the species. So it started in Europe and particularly France. And then I think it was kind of globalized to some extent by Hollywood in the post-war years. But in many countries, it is seen as a kind of foreign import of sorts. I mean, most of Asia, certainly large breasts were not cherished. Chinese noble women and Japanese geishas actually bound their breasts. They kind of flattened themselves, and that was what was perceived as sexy. If you go to any tribal culture in the tropics, which hasn't been invaded by missionaries converting people to Christianity, you'll find most people are top free. Mm. And, you know, there'll be women who may have necklaces or tattoos or, you know, various kind of things draped over them. But there's not this compulsion or this kind of cultural requirement to cover the nipples in the same way there is in our culture. You know, one of Eve's great revelations in the Garden of Eden was, you know, hey, sister, cover up. Hinduism has been much more breast friendly, and you have very boobacious goddesses in that tradition. And all the indigenous cultures around the world, breasts are not sexualized. Mm. I mean, they're a sensitive part. You know, our lips, our ears, our necks, we have many sensitive areas, but they're not like boing.
I want to go back to something you said about the feminist movement and how breasts have not been a key issue. Explain to me why not.
Second wave feminism and feminism in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was really trying to give women the rights that men had. the right to your own property, the right to a credit card that wasn't, you know, your husband's, the right to work, the right to a great job, the right to equal pay, the right to abortion, which is the right not to have children, were very much the focus of the movement. So there was less focus on what was uniquely wonderful and special about women, which is our ability to give birth and nourish the young. I think now we're at a stage where we can think about this. And breastfeeding was not really a feminist issue, interestingly. And I think it should be. A lot of women are reporting that it's harder and harder to breastfeed in public nowadays. And that makes it life very difficult for many women. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Mm. And I feel for women running through the grocery store or something with a screaming child. You know, because they can't wait to get in their car to feed their child, when sometimes you wish, maybe they should just have a seat over there.
I want to ask you about breastfeeding, because I have three kids, and I have to say my relationship changed with my breasts when I started breastfeeding. They are kind of magical food makers, and we know that intellectually, and then we have children, and it's like, wow, these things are magical. And I want you to tell me, I know you talked to some milk bankers. These are women who use their breast milk, donate to others. I used some woman's milk from Ohio for my children, for my newborn twins who needed more milk. But I want you to tell us a story that you write about. I think her name is Alicia. And what?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and what it says about the power of breasts.
You know, There is this notion that the body keeps score, that every kind of breast experience we have gets packed away somewhere in our bodily consciousness. Alicia was the unfortunate victim of sexual abuse as a child, and it related to her top half. And when she became pregnant, she decided that she could not breastfeed. She talked about it with her therapist. She talked about it with her doctors, and she had just resolved that she would use formula. But then about 6 months into the pregnancy, her breasts started weeping colostrum, which is the very nutritious for milk. You know, she was kind of shocked, but she started saving it. By the time her son Diego arrived, she had a freezer full of colostrum. Hmm. And also she was a hyperlactator. So she was fully engorged with milk. And the only thing she could do was really to pump, to just get it off her chest. So she fed Diego, only ever had her breast milk, and he had it raw and generally fresh. She also kept a freezer. She donated over 80 gallons to her local milk bank, which happened to be in San Jose. The two oldest human milk banks in North America are in Vancouver and San Jose. Hmm. They're basically kind of sister banks. They've often been in conversation with each other, the directors. What's amazing is when Alicia gave me the interview, she said, I feel so good about my breasts now. I don't know how I could have felt so much shame, because my breasts have fed my son, Diego. He's healthy as a horse, you know. And I've also donated all of this milk to the milk bank. And I did it in memory of my sister, who had been a premature infant, and also her sister had died young, and it was a wonderful healing process for her to donate the milk in her honor. And then amazingly, I was in touch with her recently, and she said she'd had another child, and she hadn't pumped once, and that she'd breastfed her daughter the whole time. And I was like, that's healing. And she says, I love my breasts. They're a source of love. They're part of the way I've shown love to my children and given my children the best start they could have in terms of their health. And so I completely support a woman's right to choose what she does with the top half of her body, including a woman's right to choose formula. I don't know what people's circumstances are, and who am I to judge? You know, we all do the best we can. You know, choice is never on a level playing field. But I do love Alicia's story, because it reveals how the different uses and thoughts of our body, about our body, can heal our minds and our bodies. And I feel that Tits Up, while researching it and writing it, was very much a healing journey for me, learning about other women's perspectives on their breasts, and they might be bra designers, they might be plastic surgeons, they might be these amazing women who donate hundreds and thousands of ounces to their local milk bank. They could be strippers. I've learned so much. It's been healing for me, and I've had people who've said, I feel just a lot better about my own little rack or big rack or whatever. Many North American women are dissatisfied with their own chest. And that's sad to me because, hey, it's right under our faces. It's emblematic of womanhood. And the fact that these things are denigrated, I think, is actually truly a political problem. And it comes from being maybe over-sexualized. It's not just about what they look like. It's not just what the male gaze. It's not just about what we even see in the mirror. What do they feel like, you know? And what have they done? And loving them is a kind of a gateway to body positivity, as one of my burlesque dancers shared with me.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. It's a lot of interesting stuff to think about.
Thank you, Pia.
Sarah Thornton is a sociologist and the author of Tits Up. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.